This spring, some high school graduates in the West may find themselves with good job prospects. The recent spike in metal prices combined with a shortage of miners means mining companies are hiring in Idaho, Montana, Alaska, and Nevada. So some teens are opting not to go to college and instead heading underground. Jessica Robinson of the Northwest News Network reports these high-paying jobs also come at a cost.
Don Conchivar teaches high school in the small town of Mullen in North Idaho's remote Silver Valley. He's the assistant principal, basketball coach, and shop teacher. Lately, Conchivar has been questioning his own career path. He watches his students parlay the skills he teaches them in this industrial mechanics class into lucrative mining jobs.
Some of them, in the first 6-8 months, their salaries absolutely crush mine.
Entry-level mine jobs can pay $50,000 a year. Lately, Conchivar has been thinking he could get a similar offer from local mine bosses.
You know, I've got 9 more years so I can get my retirement here. And then when I retire, I'll probably go to see if they'll hire me. Hopefully, I won't be too old.
So your retirement plan is to go work at a mine?
Well, yeah, I've been in teaching. I need to have a retirement plan.
The price of silver ore coming out of North Idaho suddenly makes that possible. After a long bust, this boom has mining companies wooing workers. Conchivar's son, Hunter, is one of those being courted by local mines. Hunter's in this job class, too. Hey, it's a small town.
Crew bosses, they said that they can get me jobs for, like, the summer when I turn 18, but I don't want to risk it.
You don't want to risk it?
The cave-ins and everything kind of scared me.
He's talking about a pair of fatalities last year at the Lucky Friday mine just a mile from this high school. Because of the risks, mining companies are offering incentives. Many people's paychecks have remained stagnant or disappeared in this area over the last few years, but mining salaries have risen. The average mine worker in the Silver Valley now makes $70,000. Some make six figures.
Oh, hang on a second, my phone is ringing. My name is Nick Tompkins with Newmont Mining Corporation. I'm the director for talent acquisition.
Denver-based Newmont was one of three mining companies that held recruitment fairs on the same day last month in Idaho's Silver Valley.
We've had quite a few people come through to talk to us, and we're very interested in talking to as many more as we can.
A recent report commissioned by the mining industry found that a decade-long bust in metal prices led to a lost generation of miners. As the old-timers retire, their ranks will need to be filled by young workers. 19-year-old Brandon Farman is one of those kids.
Every day in school, when I'd be sitting in class, sitting at a desk, listening to some teacher ramble on about something I wouldn't listen to, my big thing is that I could be making money right now.
Farman graduated from high school last year and went straight to work in the mine. Now he has cuts on his arms and a few blackened fingernails. He knows it's dangerous.
Nothing gives down there. The only thing that's going to give is your body.
Farman made a deal with his grandmother. After a few years in the mine, he'll go to college. But giving up this job will be hard. Farman just bought a new snowmobile, and he says when his high school friends come home from college, they're broke.
Asking mom and dad for money and stuff, you know, that sucks. I'd hate that. And then, like, a lot of them keep asking me how much I make, and they'll be telling me how much they're going to be making, and I'm like, yeah, you're going to have ways to go to catch up to me.
Of course, that will depend on his body holding up and the price of silver staying high. For NPR News, I'm Jessica Robinson in Coeur d'Alene.
Every year across the country, roughly 750,000 high school dropouts try to improve their educational and employment prospects by taking the General Educational Development Test, or GED. It's long been considered the equivalent of a high school diploma. However, the latest research shows that people with GEDs are in fact no better off than dropouts when it comes to their chances of getting a good job. This is raising a lot of questions, especially in school districts with rising GED enrollments. NPR's Claudio Sanchez reports.
First, a little history. The GED was created in 1942 for the U.S. military to test World War II veterans in reading, writing, math, science, and social studies. It was in lieu of a high school diploma so that returning soldiers could apply for a job or enroll in college. Today, the GED is a credential for high school dropouts looking for a second chance.
My name is Josue Benjamin Bolaños de Paz. Or I just go by Josue Bolaños, whichever you prefer.
Bolaño is among the 12,000 dropouts in Los Angeles who returned to school this year. He dropped out of high school 10 years ago. Here at the Abram Friedman Occupational Center, Bolaño passed his GED and then got hooked, giving people haircuts. But not just any haircut.
I'm able to do faces in people's heads.
That's right. Bolaño can draw Bob Marley, Marilyn Monroe, Malcolm X, anyone you want, on a person's head with an electric razor for as much as $125. Bolaño says it may not be one of those 21st century skills some teachers talk about, but he's making a good living as a barber. And none of it would have been possible, says Bolaño, if he had not come back for his GED.
A lot of people try to downsize the GED. But see, to me, my opinion, it tells others that at least he has some type of knowledge.
In this economy, though, that's just not enough.
The GED is a credential. Is it adequate for gainful employment and a living wage in the United States of America today? I do not think so.
That's L.A. School Superintendent John Daisy. His top lieutenant in charge of adult and career education, Ed Morris, is even more blunt.
If I were prepared today with a GED, and that's what I had as an 18-year-old, I'd be scared to death of the future.
Morris says employers require so much more than what the GED delivers, which is why some students question its value.
Truth is, I don't want a GED.
Unlike older dropouts at the Friedman Center, 18-year-old Juan Valera can still earn a high school diploma by retaking the courses he failed in high school. Valera wants to pursue a degree in criminal justice and eventually join the FBI. But right now, he says, a GED wouldn't even get him in the door to Burger King.
Every day when I leave here and I go home, I stop by and ask, are you trying to hire? I bother them.
Let's say they interview two people for the same job, says Valera.
But one has a GED, one has a high school diploma. Someone is far more likely to hire someone who has a high school diploma.
Valera's experience has been the same everywhere he's applied. Costco, Walmart, Sears, Best Buy. Companies want a credential that says, I have the knowledge and skills to handle a job. And that's where the GED falls short, says Russell Rumberger, author of the book, Dropping Out.
And if you look at employer surveys, or what are the things that employers generally most look for or think are important, especially at lower-end jobs, are the things like perseverance and tenacity and those kinds of qualities that are not measured by the GED.
Rumberger, a professor of education at UC Santa Barbara, says a high school diploma means you went to school for 4 years, did the work, passed the classes, and didn't quit. A GED, on the other hand, is a shortcut.
The GED is better than no credential for a dropout, but it's not as good as a diploma. It doesn't replace a diploma in terms of labor market outcomes.
The research also shows that only 1 in 10 GED recipients earns a college degree. Today, this is perhaps the GED's biggest challenge.
We couldn't agree more with that statement, and that is why we are making the changes that we're making to the GED testing program.
Nicole Shestang is vice president of the GED Testing Service, the organization that administers the test. Some critics would like to scrap the GED altogether, but Shestang says that's not going to happen. Instead, in 2014, the GED will morph into two new tests, one that's aligned with more rigorous high school standards, the other more attuned to career and college readiness.
And so we are developing a GED test in the future, which will point toward more information for employers and colleges and individuals about the basic skills that they have and at what level have they mastered them.
Which would bring the GED back to its original purpose, conceived 70 years ago. Claudia Sanchez, NPR News.
Listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Melissa Block. Harvard University is enjoying a rare turn in the basketball spotlight. Harvard grad Jeremy Lin has become a sudden sensation with the New York Knicks. But Harvard's current men's basketball team is also making its mark. Thanks to two powerful Ivy League recruiting tools, its academic reputation, and a big increase in financial aid. Doug Tribou with the public radio program Only a Game reports.
Harvard is on top of the Ivy League basketball standings, and there's a buzz about the team. Even a late January road game against the struggling squad from Brown University was a sellout. With a 21-3 overall record and some impressive non-conference wins, the Crimson spent part of the season in the top 25 in national polls for Division I. The Ivy League does not allow athletic scholarships, but over the past several years, member schools have dramatically increased the grants for need-based financial aid for all low- and middle-income students, aid that often allows the students to completely avoid loans. At a news conference at Harvard's home court on Monday, fifth-year head coach Tommy Amaker said eliminating loans has made it easier to compete for recruits.
It's money, and certainly an opportunity to pay for an educational opportunity here and other places in our league is a wonderful opportunity, a wonderful thing, but it also can be, a great deal of expense, and you have other places that can provide something completely free.
According to Harvard, over 60% of all the university's students receive aid, including most football and basketball players. Harvard forward Kyle Casey was recruited by a number of programs, including Stanford and Vanderbilt. The 6'7" junior says Ivy financial aid gives academically talented athletes more choices.
A lot of kids, not just in basketball, but just in general with sports, feel like, if I can go to a pretty good school and go for free, I'd rather do that than, go to a very good school and have to pay and put that burden on my parents.
Casey says knowing that attending college won't leave you in debt makes Harvard and other Ivy League schools much more attractive. Pete Thamel covers college basketball for the New York Times and says the change is noticeable.
The recruiting process in the Ivy League has always been competitive, just because there's always been a finite number of kids who have the academic qualifications and who are good enough to play Division I basketball. I think we've seen a shift in the past 4 or 5 years of the caliber of players in the Ivy League. The Ivy League is as good as it's been in this generation.
Ivy League Executive Director Robin Harris says no loan aid has broadened the pool of potential recruits, but national success is nothing new for the league, including the Cornell men's Sweet 16 berth in the 2010 NCAA basketball tournament.
But we've been competitive for longer than that. And so even if you look at the Cornell team, I don't know that very many, if any, of those players would have benefited from the changes in the financial aid policy. Our lacrosse teams have long been very competitive nationally, ice hockey, wrestling, soccer.
Sports Illustrated reporter and Harvard alum Pablo Torre says grads playing in the NBA, NFL, and other pro leagues provide a critical boost to Ivy recruiting. But in the end, academics will always be the school's best closing argument.
Harvard is never going to have, or Princeton is never going to have, the resources that Ohio State, Michigan has in terms of, just all the accoutrements that are part and parcel with a big-time program, but they're going to try and make up for it on the back end when they say, even if you don't make it, you're going to have this degree, and that's pretty useful.
Right now, the Harvard men are focused on their more immediate future. Ivy League degrees can open a lot of doors, but so can conference victories. The team that eventually finishes first in the Ivy League gets an automatic bid to the NCAA tournament. For NPR News, I'm Doug Tribou in Boston.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. It's a midweek winter's night in Kansas City, Missouri. In a lecture hall on the University of Missouri campus, a debate on the city's future is set to begin.
I thank you all so much for coming to our debate here tonight.
There are no politicians or pundits. Instead, three neatly pressed, accomplished young college debaters earnestly discuss some of the ideas for the future of the public school system from which they graduated.
I believe the best place to kind of start this dialogue on my end would be with the state of the district.
The debate is not strictly academic. The Missouri State School Board revoked the Kansas City Public School District's accreditation on January 1st. The district met just 3 of the 14 standards of the Missouri Board of Education. It flunked the minimum proficiency standards for math, English, and science, attendance, and graduation rates. An eighth grader named Jack Knack told a Missouri State Senate committee why his family sacrificed to send him to a parochial school.
Even though it was a struggle for my family, the reputation of the public schools in my area was not as good as my parents would have hoped.
And Yak Nak and his family are refugees from Sudan. All Kansas City public school families have to struggle with that decision now. Should they try to afford a parochial or private school, move, or keep their children in a system that's been marked a failure, and hope their children don't lose out if they stay?
We have a city that every year just goes, well, check them off. We lost them. We don't want to deal with this, but somebody's got to do it.
Fifi Weideman is a lifelong Kansas Cityan and former Kansas City school board member who thinks she can trace where the district began to decline.
My father was a real estate appraiser, And in 1969, when the Kansas City Star announced that the district was now half black, I remember him saying, that's the end.
Her father meant white middle-class families would leave the city for the suburbs, taking their children out of Kansas City schools. By the mid-1980s, Kansas City, like other urban centers, had a few good public schools in mostly white middle-class neighborhoods and underperforming schools in poor minority neighborhoods. So in 1985, a federal district judge took control of the Kansas City School District and ordered that nearly $2 billion be spent to bus students to integrate the schools and improve them. The district went on a binge, building 15 new schools, lowering classroom size, raising teacher salaries, even adding Olympic-sized swimming pools, a robotics lab, and a 25-acre wildlife sanctuary, all to try to bring middle-class families back. We're in front of Southwest High School, which has a roster of famous alumni, including the founders of H&R Block and Calvin Trillin. The district built a planetarium here for this school, but middle-class families turned out to want better test scores, not bright stars. And the school district continued to shrink, from about 77,000 students in the 1960s to just under 16,000 today. To reduce costs in 2010, the district closed almost half the schools in Kansas City. You see boarded-up schools in almost every neighborhood now, looking like dead brick dinosaurs. Some schools were merged. They weren't always good matches. Fifi Weideman says Southwest High School swelled from 500 students to 1,800.
With no real plan, absolutely no plan. It didn't take a rocket science to know that there was going to be major. It was bound to explode.
A troubling day at Southwest High School in Kansas City, Missouri. Police had to be called and the school locked down after a series of fights broke out.
Three fires and a fight. Today's chaos and damage at Southwest was so bad.
Also, the police department reporting in 81 calls just this school season, two of them false reports.
And instability at the top school levels inflamed many problems. Andrea Flinders, president of the Kansas City Teachers Union, lists some of the school superintendents she's known over the last decade.
We have Green, then it was Covington, Coleman, Amato, Taylor, Garcia.
So in the time that more or less American Idol has been on the air.
Good point.
There have been six, seven, or eight school superintendents.
Yeah, that's probably right.
She says each new superintendent brought in their own new systems, new goals, and new people. This created confusion, constantly changing standards, and an atmosphere of chaos. Dr. Stephen Green, Kansas City's interim superintendent, brought us to Miss Taylor's second grade class at Primitivo Garcia Elementary School on the city's west side, which seems a picture of success, attentive students and a patient teacher.
We know who the characters are. We know what the setting is. Now we're talking about a plot.
But Dr. Green acknowledges that the Missouri School Board pulled their accreditation only after 20 years of decline.
Accreditation is the state's way of saying that we are putting you on notice that you have 2 years to get this matter corrected. Not the same as a university, in which a university is unaccredited, and that means that the diploma does not carry the validity that it would. It is a definite signal of alarm and concern.
His predecessor, Dr. John Covington, won public support to close all those schools, then abruptly resigned at the start of this school year and took a job in Michigan. After he'd pledged to help bring stability to the district, hard feelings may remain. May I ask, have you talked to Dr. Covington?
Yes.
Any advice you can share?
No.
So now the crisis in the Kansas City schools presents each parent with a personal decision. How long do you keep your child in a school system that's gotten a failing grade? But if you leave, will anything be left to save?
They just get off the bus right here. And then
the Martinez family lives in a handsome home on a hill in the Coleman Highlands neighborhood. It's the kind of secure and cheerful home where children's paintings are framed and their playmates come and go through an unlocked back door. They've got two children in the Kansas City district and would like them to be able to stay. But the Martinez's say they watch every day for warning signs, like...
The good teachers leaving. My children
not enjoying school, coming home upset because of things that might have happened at school. We scratch our heads and ask ourselves all the time if we're doing the right thing by leaving them in a district that has so many issues and trouble.
Luciel and Adriana Piscina came by. They have four youngsters in the Kansas City public schools, from a kindergartner to Jimena, a high school sophomore who also joined us. The Piscinas say they're committed to keeping their children in the Kansas City schools.
We think there's some things here that we should fight for, because if we all run away, we'll never fix the problems.
But Jimena Piscina is more openly anxious. She's had to say goodbye to friends.
Many students are leaving. There's kids saying, oh, well, I'm going to this private school. I'm actually moving out of this state. I'm going to Kansas. And it's tragic.
So we risked another question in front of Jimena's clearly loving parents. Does she sometimes wonder why her family keeps her and her siblings in Kansas City public schools?
Oh, yeah. I have cousins and a lot of friends that aren't part of the district. I get jealous at times. I get asked a lot, well, doesn't your school do that? Our schools do that. And I get asked questions that just make me feel really sad, and they make me feel like I'm part of a school that doesn't really have anything. Like, I feel really poor.
Jimena Piscina and her parents, Adriana and Luciel Piscina, among the many Kansas City families who now face hard personal choices about if they'll be part of the future of the Kansas City schools. Next week, part two of our story and contending proposals for the future.